Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chanbaker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the racing car bunk bed that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we hit our 80th episode milestone. Oh my God. We're going through our open tabs as always, and we will be discussing machines replacing our memories, reviving the idea of the medieval guild, and finally, our newly launched campaign, Use It or Lose It. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very, very special guest, Stanislava Pinchuk, aka Miso. Stan, as we'll refer to here, as well as being a close friend of the show, is a very uniquely talented and fascinating artist, well known for her work with data mapping the changing topographies of war and conflict zones, such as the current civil war in her home country, Ukraine, the Fukushima and Chernobyl Reactor 4 nuclear exclusion zones, the oil fire set by ISIS south of Mosul, and the Calais jungle migrant camp. She produces drawings, installations, and sculptures shown in museums globally, and her work has been collected and supported by institutions such as the Louvre, the National Gallery of Australia, Heidi MoMA, and Sydney's Museum of Contemporary Art. On the commercial end, she's worked with clients such as Louis Vuitton, Chanel, Gucci, Apple, and Nike, and she's also just topped the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. It's a genuine honor to have her joining us today. Stan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really well.
Our pleasure.
You've done a few open tabs with us, and it's always been fun diving into what is going on in your life at any given point, because each time I see you, you've been off in some other country doing something that I could only probably not even dream of. I remember one of the few was that you were beekeeping in the Sahara or something at some point. I just don't even know. My life feels so boring compared to yours. Where have you been lately? Have you been in Melbourne?
No, I've been in Sarajevo.
Of course you have.
And I've been beekeeping in Paris.
Of course you have.
As you do.
As you do. Jeremy, well, how are you doing?
I have neither been beekeeping or traveling anywhere. I often say that my life is like one of those, what are they called? Breezeways? You know, those like covered walkways between buildings they have in like Dubai.
Yeah.
And there's one in the city. It's like, so my life, like after like the last few years, like a breezeway between my home and the office. Like I just kind of go, back and forth, but it's fine. You know,
you like your home and you like your office.
I do. And the leaves are changing. They're just so magnificent at the moment.
I was out your way last weekend, and where you live in the hills, the like autumn is something else. It's stunning.
It's popping, as they say.
It's popping, as they say.
Well and truly popping. Laura. No, please.
I must tell you, this week I spent the night in a haunted mansion out your way.
Oh, which one? There's a few.
In the Norris building, which has been abandoned and no one slept there for 30 years.
How did you find your way into that situation?
It was legal, but we were the first people to sleep there on a dare in 30 years. Let me tell you, there is something haunted out that way.
Oh, no.
Fucked up.
No.
Did you actually manage to get to sleep, though?
I slept a little bit, yeah. But the really kinky shit started happening in the morning. Thanks to the little girl ghost with the teddy bear.
No. Seriously? No,
yeah,
I can't.
For real.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
We need to break this down in so much more detail after the show.
Yeah.
I have so many questions.
When we do our kind of our new kind of true crime and paranormal podcast.
We're going to have to if we want to stay relevant.
No, we do need to pivot soon. Laura, get us started here with the first link of the week. What do you got?
Yeah. So today all I can think about is the teddy bear ghost. But no, today I've got a piece from Eon, which I think perhaps might be the first time the outlet's actually featured on the show. I'm not sure. But anyway, the piece is by Gene Tracy, who is a professor of physics in his normal life. And it's titled, How Much Can We Afford to Forget If We Train Machines to Remember? And it's a fairly short for me, think piece about the way that evolutions in tech over human history have impacted the skills and general knowledge retained by most people. In particular, the way in recent times things like smartphones, search engines, Wikipedia, Siri, various sort of AI might affect how and what we learn and think. And recently, I've been having conversations with various people about some of these questions, but particularly in how they relate to creativity and creative text. So when this article popped up, it drew some really interesting parallels, I thought. And we've talked a lot on the podcast about the kind of overwhelming sameness that we're seeing these days in a lot of art, or in particular in illustration, and why this might be. But I thought this could be a kind of interesting link to look at that conversation from a bit of a new angle. So first, some sections of the article to just lay some foundations for our chat. Gene writes, It's common to frame discussions of societal transitions by focusing on the new skills that become essential. But instead of looking at what we're learning, perhaps we should consider the obverse, what becomes safe to forget. In 2018, Science magazine asked dozens of young scientists what schools should be teaching the next generation. Many said that we should reduce the time spent on memorizing facts and give more space for creative pursuits. As the internet grows ever more powerful and comprehensive, why bother to remember and retain information? Mm-hmm. If students can access the world's knowledge on a smartphone, why should they be required to carry so much of it around in their heads? And it's this question that kind of really got me thinking, well, a lot of things, but really got me thinking about the role that tools, platforms, and software like Photoshop or Procreate or Instagram, Tiltbrush, iPads, et cetera, play in creativity and that sort of push and pull between the opportunities that they create and the skills and knowledge that they potentially erode. So Jean continues, civilizations evolved through strategic forgetting of what were once considered vital life skills. After the agrarian revolution of the Neolithic era, a farm worker could afford to let go of much woodland lore, skills for animal tracking, and other knowledge vital for hunting and gathering. In subsequent millennia, when societies industrialized, reading and writing became vital, while the knowledge of plowing and harvesting could fall by the wayside. Many of us now get rapidly lost without our smartphone GPS. Myself included. So what's next? With driverless cars, will we forget how to drive ourselves? Surrounded by voice recognition AIs that can pass the most subtle utterances, will we forget how to spell? And does it matter? Most of us no longer know how to grow the food we eat or build the homes we live in, after all. We don't understand animal husbandry or how to spin wool or perhaps even how to change the spark plugs in a car. Most of us don't need to know these things because we are members of what social psychologists call transactive memory networks. So these networks that he talks about, they're basically the interactions that we have with the people around us, or what he calls memory partners, through conversation, reading, writing, and whatever else. And because someone in your network retains the information, most people no longer need to remember most things because the load is kind of shared between you. And you just have to know sort of who to talk to or where to go to look it up. And Jean calls this inherited talent for such, you know, cooperative behavior a gift from evolution because of just how enormously it expands our memory capacity. But what is new, though, is that many of our memory partners now, these sort of smart machines, and so we've got things like Google search, which is this, you know, immediately responsive, always available AI, giving us access to a large portion of the kind of entire store of human knowledge. And he notes a few interesting things here. For example, the issue that although we understand humans are flawed, we somehow kind of perceive AI algorithms to be objective or unbiased or, you know, correct. And we take that on the, you know, on its face. And he also looks at the concept of the kind of extended mind and the potential future for neural implants, augmenting people's brains with computer interfaces. And then, of course, you know, the huge risks in a society that relies so completely on networks if those networks ever go down. But I want to put our own spin on things and get back to the question of creativity. I posted this particular article last week in our Corvid community Slack, and one of our artists, Bill Hope, hi Bill, made a point that there are so many digital tools that allow you to skip learning the fundamentals. And while he loves these tools for how they speed up the process, especially for commercial work, it is always a worry when he feels himself being guided by those tools. And Stan, I'm really curious about how this kind of tension applies to your own work and whether you feel that it is still really important to learn the fundamentals in this day and age and what you would even consider to be the fundamentals now.
I love this article. And I think it touched on something really, really fundamental and vital to any kind of taxonomy or science or arts. And I guess as someone who's kind of got one foot in the science camp and the data camp and the tech camp and one in the arts and humanities camp, what I thought it touched on for me that was so interesting is there's a lot of focus on having the answer. And actually so much science and so much creativity is about not just asking the question, but asking the right question or giving the right input for the correct answer. So I think that's something really interesting. And how much do you need to know the fundamentals?
To actually ask the right question. So in terms of the sort of art, what do you consider to be, I mean, I think people look at the fundamentals as, you know, being able to draw or, I don't know, being able to sort of understand proportions or whatever it is. Do you think those things are important for someone who wants to be a functioning artist today, or is it not necessary for everybody?
I don't think there's anything necessary for anybody in creativity. I don't think there is one thing that's fundamental or applicable to everyone. But I think when you see someone like Picasso and you think about a trajectory like that, is someone who really needed to know the classicist foundations and proportions and all these things to then bust out of that box
yeah.
completely and with reason and with great effect.
I always say that with language, like to be a good writer, you do need to, it's not necessarily about following all the rules, but it's about knowing the rules so you know how and when you can break them skillfully. And the same probably applies with art. Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, I'm interested in hearing more from you, Stan, about how this really works with your kind of practice, particularly, especially kind of around war zones. And I kind of think one of the more disturbing things that I'm kind of seeing recently is that people that the older we get, the more people forget about what has happened in our past. And I think, you know, especially from a personal level, like all the kind of anti-Semitic things kind of happening in the world, you know, when you have generations that didn't live with people who passed on, you know, what happened in the Holocaust and in kind of Nazi Germany. And obviously, you know, that whole idea of memory, like we have to keep these things alive in our head. And I really kind of, one of the things that really attracts me to your work is that it does this in a very kind of real way, you know, that there are these kind of reminders there. So I'm just curious, is that kind of something that is deliberate in your work? Are you trying to kind of evoke these memories and you have your own kind of personal memories and you're trying to kind of create this kind of documentation? And yeah, like, is there, and I know you're someone who's very kind of technologically focused and driven as well. I'm just kind of wondering how those kind of two things intersect, if they do at all.
Thank you. Yeah, that means a lot. And I'm kind of really with you on that. For me, tech is always the tool or the support network. It's never the thing in itself or the gimmick or the novelty of a new tech advancement. You know, I think it's always in support of something greater and bigger and something, you know, a much bigger question of humanity, I guess. So what I thought that article was so great in touching upon and something I believe in so strongly and why my work is structured the way that it is about the need for science and tech graduates to have an education in the humanities and maybe in philosophy or ethics, and maybe something like this that frees up learning fundamentals of how to do long division rather than knowing how to ask the calculator how to long divide, is maybe in our universities could free up space for tech, for science graduates to maybe go into philosophy or do courses from purely their curiosity,
Completely.
You know, and to be interdisciplinary and put feet in different camps, I guess.
Yeah, I think people are always better at whatever it is that they do when they are interdisciplinary, at least in their own personal interests, and draw from those things. It's interesting because, yeah, in these conversations I said, I've been talking to various artists over the last week, and there is such a mix of, yeah, being so genuinely excited about the time it frees up, particularly when you're looking at, sort of software, you know, the time it frees up, and also just the opportunities it allows for, let's say we're looking at kind of VR capabilities or whatever else might be, you know, the kind of things that previously most people without highly, highly, highly specialized skills and training and whatever wouldn't have been able to participate in, and how exciting that is when these things become sort of economized. But then also, I guess a lot of the tension or the concern comes not so much from those tools, but from things like Instagram or even Google or whatever, and how we're all sort of seeing the same things, and that, you know, when you put all the same things into the human, then the same thing comes out, you know? I can never stop myself from reading comment sections, my favorite part of any article. And this one had some interesting additional thoughts in it, particularly this one from San Lehman Wiltzig, great name, which read, "Really creative thinking is always a function of recombining disparate facts, ideas, etc., that at first sight don't seem to have any connection. Humans do not do creatio ex nihilo, something from nothing," and I don't know how to speak Latin, so. "Thus, for anyone to be creative, they need the disparate facts to be in their memory, and then the brain can associatively pluck them out of memory to create a new idea. Lacking a broad knowledge of ideas, facts, etc., there is no basis for creative thought. One cannot simply ask Google what two different ideas can be combined in a creative way, or here's an original idea of mine, what two disparate facts could support that? So memory is critical, not just for remembering things, but for creating new things." And I loved that comment. I thought that was great. And I think that definitely touches upon what you were saying. Jeremy, do you agree with this? Like, I think this does sort of fall in line with this kind of this theme that we keep talking about platforms producing this kind of homogenous view, this landscape, and how that sort of inversely leads people to create more of the same. Or maybe we're just jaded. What do you think?
What do you mean? How does that relate to memory in that way?
Well, I just think in terms of not having a broad knowledge of ideas, of themes, of whatever, if you're just taking in a lot of the same art rather than, let's say, drawing inspiration from all sorts of different parts of the world and knowledge and whatever, how that produces this kind of homogenous work.
Yeah, I mean, it's dangerous. Messing with memory and messing kind of with our attention is doing things that I don't think we really kind of know what the long-term effects are going to be. And I think articles like this kind of pop up when we start realizing, oh, things are a bit kind of strange. And I always kind of feel that for someone like me, I always kind of looked at my appetite for information and curiosity as kind of a really kind of positive aspect of my practice. And overall, like I think in more recent years, I'm actually thinking, this actually maybe is more kind of an intellectual greed of some kind of, you know, that it's not coming from a positive place. It's coming from this idea of kind of consuming information because so much of it is out there. And I kind of feel that, yeah, like even now sometimes, like I feel much more sensitive about like what I'm kind of putting into my head, you know, and like, well, I mean, the brain is insane in terms of how many connections are there, what it can hold. But the more logical side of me thinks like, you know, like if I put this thing in, is it displacing kind of something else?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, I was watching Game of Thrones last night. I was like, do I really want this in my head? You know, like, in
yes.
this way.
Yes, you do.
That was the answer, yes.
Yes.
In the end. But like, you know, I think we're much more kind of sensitive now about kind of what we're putting in and kind of this whole kind of diet that we kind of, you know, feed ourselves. And I kind of think this kind of connects a bit to what Stephen Wolfram was doing. You know, we're talking about his methods in terms of he was actually out kind of sourcing all of his output in a way. And so I think that was kind of interesting in a way that I feel like, well, if that was me, I could maybe relax a bit more, kind of knowing, not feeling kind of so much pressure to kind of keep things in, but that it would be there to kind of draw on. And I kind of think that could have really great creative repercussions. I know I'm kind of going away from the question here only because like I don't think I can kind of fully answer or that's not kind of what I was kind of drawn to. But I think, yeah, we need to be really careful in terms of how we kind of use our minds and in terms of and how we decide to interact with kind of information. I think there's this inherent quality now that we're being rewarded for being kind of lazy when we're kind of seeking out information and only kind of skimming and only kind of just getting all these kind of little bits and pieces. So yeah.
Because I feel like I just even think about, you know, not that long ago, but like the idea of having to go to a library and read through like a million different books to find the piece of information that I wanted for some assignment I had to do or whatever just feels like really foreign now.
Well, now it's hard to get the right information because it's out there in so many places and in there in so many ways as well. I don't know. You know, memory is such a funny one.
It is.
I used to joke all the time, like when, you know, and I was really working more in the Melbourne art scene, like if you go through like the Next Wave catalog, at least like 9 out of 10 projects would be like the subtitle would be The Fragile Nature of Memory.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's always this thing that people love exploring because, yeah, it's a kind of universal thing. And I love seeing how it's explored in places like pop culture, like Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, like messing with memory.
Or Black Mirror.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, in all these conversations I've been having with various artists, there's definitely a mixed feeling between being kind of like overwhelmed by new tools and worried about like focusing too much on that instead of just making things. And then there's also, yeah, that excitement I was saying about the potential to do all sorts of things that weren't possible before. Stan, I'd love to know if there's any sort of tech that you are particularly excited about using in your work.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And I think the more that I talk about it all the time, I just keep coming back to the idea that everything is concept. And with what I do and when you're an artist, at the end of the day, everything is the strength of concept. And whether tech adds to it or allows you to facilitate it, at the end of the day, it's sort of not the most important thing.
It's irrelevant. It's about what it is you're doing.
Absolutely. I think what's really interesting with my work is speaking of science and humanities, I come from the philosophy faculty and I come from punk rock and I've come from graffiti. And there was always a big part of me that was very academic, very scientific, very mathematic. And I knew it would come into my work one day. And it did very naturally. So in some ways, I'm kind of playing catch up to tech and learning. And luckily for punk rock, I have this DIY thing. So with every project, given the nature of what I do, is I don't have the luxury to have a way that I work. When you work in war zones, when you work in conflict zones, there are a lot of restrictions from security to access to the time you can spend being radiated by a high amount of microsieverts.
I know the
feeling. Thought you were especially glowing today, but I didn't want to say anything. Oh, sorry. Terrible dad joke.
I tell you, you get one per segment on the show.
As long as I get one, that's fine. I'm so sorry. Go on.
Is there a jingle that plays after the dad joke?
It should be.
You can insert. So, for me, because I have all these restrictions and because I'm learning, I've never had the luxury to go into a place and apply the method that I work in. So every time I've had to kind of adapt and really look at my surroundings and see what I can do, what I can't do. So some technology I'm really excited to work with is drones. Simple as that. My last project was the first project that I could have airspace access. And that changed the game for me completely.
I can imagine with the kind of work that you do. Yeah.
There are some really great 3D scanners that can be applied to iPads and can scan topography or objects to make 3D meshes, which then is, you know, really incredible to the times that I've had to work, like in Chernobyl, where you can't take a single photo at reactor 4 and you have half an hour where you just have to make a string grid and use a gyrometer and very old school. So I'm kind of excited, not just by tech, but kind of by string and a gyrometer. And,
yeah.
You know, and I think it's everything's kind of in service of concept.
Well, yeah, some really fantastic points in this piece. And yeah, and Aon also, they're based in a few places, but Melbourne as well. I have a few friends who actually kind of work there. So yeah, they're doing some really interesting work.
I didn't know they had a Melbourne base.
Yeah, I think it's one of these publications that is philanthropically supported, I think, as well. Uh-huh. So yeah, doing some really great work. So thanks for bringing to the table, Laura. We'll move on
no
from there.
Worries.
So today, my link is a very special one. Now, if you listen to the show or follow us regularly, I've teased that we had three big launches planned for 2019. First up was Corvid, which we announced a few months ago. And today we have number two rolling off the assembly line.
I need a drum roll or something.
Yes. Not literally number two, just the second of the three things that we're working on. We're obviously saving the best for last, hopefully sometime in June. But until then, I think this is pretty good. So look, without further ado.
It'll do.
So we can finally announce that our long talked about campaign around usage and licensing fees called Use It or Lose It is finally live. So yay, sound effects.
Woo-hoo.
The new little party poppers.
Crowd applauses.
So yes, that's my link for the week, basically. Okay, so what is Use It or Lose It? Where did it come from? What does it want? In short, it's a grassroots campaign designed to open up a broader dialogue over the issue of usage fees between artists and clients. Now, obviously, we have a specific interest and knowledge in illustration. However, we hope that it's something that will have a broader application across many other mediums. Now, this was really inspired by Jessica Hish's amazing letter writer. We've spoken about this on the show before. Mm. Eventually, Jessica's letter writer will become sentient and put us out of business. but until then, Use It or Lose It has, and every time I look at Use It or Lose It as an acronym, which is UIOLI, it's just
Aioli.
It's Aioli.
Yeah, and the same here.
That really should be what we call the whole thing. Anyway, it has a twofold purpose. So artists can use it to send to clients when negotiating or trying to educate clients on usage. Commissioners of artwork can use it as a resource to educate themselves or colleagues, as well as sign a pledge that outlines some of the best practices both for clients and artists and designate yourself kind of a public supporter of the goals and ideas that we kind of set out here. So the bulk of the site is made up of two letters. There's one for artists, there's one for clients. And like Jessica's letter writer, you can just kind of send the URL over as required. And if you're truly passionate about the cause, you take the pledge and you get publicly displayed there. There's also a great resource section, which is, I think right now, like about 60 or 70 articles, podcasts, blogs, videos, et cetera, to further dive into, along with some links to the live copy so we can take direct and anonymous suggestions for future updates. And the whole thing is also licensed under Creative Commons, so anyone can take any part of it for your own materials or processes. And the resource section is really amazing because there's always things that kind of pop up, like whether it's kind of like Peloton being fined for not properly licensing $150 million worth of music, or how the Nike logo designer was kind of just paid for in a little stock and $150. So there's all these kind of stories about usage and licensing are actually kind of underneath all of our kind of experience as creatives. And I think of everything, that's one of the sections that I like the most. So yes, this is something that's been cooking for years now, but it was really super hard to find the time to actually sit down and get it right. And I don't even know if it's really 100% out there yet. Like, it's kind of been ready for the last few months, but like, you know, we've just been hemming and hawing. There's been a lot of hesitation kind of putting out there. It feels weird to kind of take a stand like this, but it's something we feel all quite strongly about. We just felt we had to get it out there. So we did it. It's out there now. Now,
no taking it back.
No taking it back. Obviously, every job and every conversation around licensing is different. And that's one of the things that we loved about Jessica's letter writer, particularly that such different scenarios could be input and that you can get something a bit more custom out of each one. That said, licensing is such a different beast that we really need to take a different approach. And originally, we were just going to have two very short letters and just use an extended kind of footnotes to flesh it out more. But the more we started writing it, the more organically it grew to this more kind of Q&A format, because so many different kind of tendrils just grew out of it of needing to make sure that we cover this information. So look, why did we write this though, after all? And to be perfectly honest, in the 11 plus years of running Jackie Winter, I had to say that of all the most challenging conversations we've had with clients that, I don't know, Laura, I'm going to say 90% have been to do with usage terms or fees.
Yes.
In some cases, I think we were made to feel crazy, like for the way that we approach these issues, that we were kind of outliers. And for me personally, I found this to be Especially true here in Australia, as the landscapes really started to change dramatically with regard to the types of people who we're talking to and who are taking on certain roles. Like, for example, you might have someone from broadcast who's handling print production, or a photography art buyer commissioning animated GIFs. And each industry seemed to have its own preconceived notion of what was, you know, industry standard with regard to rights and usage. Some standards were set in more kind of cultural senses as well. So, for example, certain agencies or publishers would have their own approaches or standards or would set the tone. And then that person would move to another agency or work with a different vendor and bring those kind of preconceived notions kind of with them. So it was this really kind of informal idea of how people were kind of trained and approaching these really kind of fundamental issues. So with all this fragmentation and changing views and opinions, and in some case, total ignorance. I mean, some people just come into these roles just not knowing about these things, because as we talk about a lot here, production and kind of art buying is not something you can be trained for. You learn on the job, in that case, from other people. And, you know, you're picking up all of their habits and thoughts as well. So I felt there was a real need to try to establish something a bit more kind of standalone and serious, that not only could we use ourselves in these situations to try and educate our own clients and de-escalate sometimes stressful negotiations, but actually open it up and give it back to the community at large to become a resource that everyone could use as well. I mean, that's always been the Jackie Winter spirit. It's like, one, solve our own problem, and two, put it out there in a way that actually kind of gives back in kind of some way. So even though there's kind of this selfish aspect to it, I try to make sure there's also the flip side of it as well. So hopefully, if you listen to this podcast, you understand a bit of what usage and licensing fees are. I've gone out a lot about it, and I'm just taking that for granted. But if not, please read the campaign, because one of the main things that we're trying to do here, just starting out with, is try to position this practice as something that's pretty much the heart and soul of our current sharing economy, where nothing is owned. Everyone is entering the license agreements left and right. How many times do you click OK to, you know, iTunes when it comes up, or a new app when you download it? You are entering into these legal licensing agreements all the time, whether or not you know it. So we don't have the time to cover all the ins and outs of the topic here, which is why we launched the campaign to actually do that heavy lifting. But look, there's a hard economic truth of the matter, and it's that wages have just not increased for applied artists at the same rate of CPI or inflation. I still look at my first editorial rate card that I got from Business Week magazine when I started Jackie Winter in 2007, and I think rates have actually gone down since then.
I would say so.
And there's an increase in number of artists being trained every year entering the workforce. Combine that with an extreme downwards pressure on clients for lower costs has meant that the current state of the industry is dire. Most of our artists and other artists that I know are doing many things in addition to their core practice just to make ends meet. And it's really not sustainable.
And it doesn't produce the best work.
No. And, you know, I like a good metaphor.
Boy, don't you?
I mean, it's a bit like overfishing. So eventually, if you overfish in this area, there's going to be no more fish to catch. And then the clients and businesses who rely on having ongoing access to these artists will find that at some point, they're no longer out there because everyone made it a race to the bottom. So that's really the spirit behind the name, Use It or Lose It. It's kind of a call to those on both sides of the fence. If artists don't define and respect their own usage fees and terms, their wages will not be sustainable. If clients are not willing to go out to bat and defend these fees and terms as well, they will lose access to these artists who they rely on to make those ideas come to life. It's very simple. So if this all sounds dire, I think, well, you know, it is.
It is.
And obviously, we have a financial stake in all this. I'm not going to deny that, because without our artists working, we're not working much either. And I'm not going to deny that there's an obvious bias here. We've tried to... Well, look, that was actually one of the greatest challenges in terms of writing this. It's like, I wanted to make something that would be genuinely helpful and not seem like a marketing ploy or something too adversarial for our clients and kind of confrontational. You know, we spoke about ArtsLog before, like other kind of campaigns that were kind of done, but like really just
very us versus them.
Exactly. So that's why, that's the whole idea about Use It or Lose It. It goes on kind of both sides of...
it's about the ecosystem as a whole and all parties that are involved.
And that's why we've opened up the document as well, because I'm not pretending we know everything. We've consulted with our lawyers the best we can to try to get good facts out there. We've tried to canvass with as many people as we know, but this is something that will be kind of updated. It's like a living document. So I'm not discounting the fact that we are an adaptable and ingenious species, both of professions and kind of humans, from Patreon to full-time in-house employment. Many other creators have found ways to survive in this new reality. I mean, we spoke about last week, and I employed other organizations like the AOI, who've been very instrumental in laying the groundwork for something like this, especially in terms of highlighting some of the trickier areas where usage and licensing can crop up, such as in short-form animation, something we've been talking about a lot, a kind of an older industry that's kind of developed all this kind of new output and now trying to figure out how it exists kind of in that sphere.
And how to fund it.
Exactly. So look, I could do an entire episode on this alone. It's a meaty subject.
I think we did a licensing episode way back in season two or something.
We did, but yeah, I think and I think we probably even mentioned that we were working on that then. So it's great to finally announce it. But look, both this campaign and my comments here only scratch the surface. There are amazing people and other resources out there that go into overlapping territory, such as royalties and licensing in a merchandising capacity or value-based pricing in a more traditional creative studio model. And we tried to keep things really broad here, but the campaign really only covers a particular segment of the industry, illustration, animation, photography, that kind of thing. And there are still many more vital conversations to be had, more specific to those industries, from graphic design to live action talent, all of which we are seeing happen in their own small way. But I think the biggest point I want to make is that there really isn't a solid answer here. Even though we have a pledge, it's more about just kind of being willing to having an ongoing conversation and be open to understanding why this model is important. It's a call to arms to other independent artists to ensure they don't ignore this vital part of their practice and not sell themselves short over fear. Because I think that's what's happening. Everyone kind of is scared that they're not going to get the job or that they can't ask for this and that they can't put this as part of their practice. And I guess what I want to say is, no, it's okay. This is a real thing. This happens. This works. This is how you price your work, you know? We want to reassure people in that way. And we've spoken about this many times before, that especially in art, yeah, there's just no correlation with the time spent on something that you know, if it takes you 15 minutes to do something, that's not the value of how much it actually kind of costs financially. So usage fees aren't the perfect solution, but it's worked out very well for a long time. So why not give it a shot? Finally, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. We want to show that it is a viable and standard practice, but anyone can make it work in their own unique way. And it's a call to clients and the industry as well to consider a more generous and fair model of working, which sees everyone take a share in commercial success. And that's why I love the publishing model and royalties. I mean, royalties itself is such an archaic word when you actually kind of think about it. But the whole idea is that like everyone is kind of, even if you're trying to kind of sell life insurance, the whole idea is that you get like a team behind it and everyone who contributes and that kind of, you know, get you deliver a commercial success for your client, everyone's kind of rewarded back in that way.
Yeah, so, and the better it does, the more each person that contributed makes.
Exactly. So look, I hope this inspires some big questions and discussions here. There's so much more I want to say, but if I go on, a small hook is going to pull me out of this room. So I'm just going to open up here briefly. Laura, I want to start with you. Use It or Lose It in many ways has been your baby. I mean, you really kind
baby.
Of, you kind of wrote all the copy, basically, with my amazing guidance.
Of course.
Thank you. Even though it's been on the cards for years, it's something that we've had to do very slowly. And from a writing perspective, you really had to thread a needle in terms of drafting copy that both empowered artists, but didn't feel like a slap on the wrist to clients. And I think you've done a really fantastic job on it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Obviously, this was a group effort. I don't want to kind of, you know, discount every other person here. Jackie Winder had a major contribution here, just like we did kind of with Corvid. But there's also lots of aspects that we had to educate ourselves on. So I'm just kind of curious to hear, what did you learn in this process? Did anything surprise you?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Use It or Lose It has been a truly mammoth effort. It's been, I don't remember when we started this, but look, as we talk, I'm thinking of like more things we need to put in there. And it's like, it's just never going to be done. But I think that's the beauty of it as much as it's a pain. I think this idea has been kicking around for years now. And we originally talked about like writing articles on Medium, I think. And then, I don't know, I think I started writing this even before I was working as a producer. And then like, not surprisingly, looking back on it, it really wasn't possible then because it just didn't matter how much research I did. This is a field that is so hard to get a full grasp on until you've been in the middle of it. And, you know, aside from the materials produced by the AOI, there's not like a lot of solid sort of material on this. And then other things came up, it got put on the back burner. And then we kind of eventually like dusted the idea off, pulled it out of the attic. And, you know, by then I'd been like well and truly immersed in licensing and usage for, you know, several years. So it all came far more easily. And it was really then more about finding the right words to express all these thoughts instead of actually researching the answers. And you came up with the idea of turning it into this like full campaign stocked with all sorts of resources rather than like a one-off article. And the resulting thing is very much a combined effort between the two of us and other people, of course. I think you wrote this kind of initial outline of everything you wanted to cover. I just sort of force you to sit down and write this thing. And then together with PDA, with the developers, we worked out what the best way might be to actually sort of present that information. You mentioned that it was meant to be this like thing with annotations, blah, blah. And we realized far later than we'd liked that no, that wasn't going to work. And it was all quite a bit of a headache, but it was, you know, a learning curve. And then we began this sort of very long process of fully fleshing out writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting all the various elements. And then, you know, you'd review it, add a bunch of comments, and I'd sort of put it under the knife again. And even now that it's live, like the process just isn't totally over, because the whole idea is, yes, that it will be this evolving beast. And as we open the conversation with more artists and more clients, we do hope to continue to adjust and add to it. And I don't think there's actually much in there that we didn't already know at the beginning from our experience doing this stuff day in, day out, thousands and thousands of times over. As I said, it is really a culmination of kind of all of our combined years in this industry and the experiences and the knowledge that that's given us. And it was more a matter of writing it out in a way that could be understood and shared by others, which is really hard to take this very complex, nuanced sort of thing that's in your head and or in multiple people's heads and distill it into this, like, into these paragraphs that are like broad enough to be applied across different situations, but not so broad that they're no longer useful. And like, it's really difficult. And I think one of the hardest things about licensing is that it's such a sensitive topic a lot of the time. And so even if you know what you should be asking for, or like putting in your terms and conditions or quotes, the key thing is being really careful with the language you use so that you can effectively explain to clients and artists alike why it's important for everyone. And I think, yeah, that taking it from that us versus them language to this kind of inclusive, healthy ecosystem thing that you were sort of explaining is actually really, really hard. And that was like a huge reason why we did this, is to sort of help give people some of the language. And we say people, I mean artists and clients, to help give them some of the language they needed to actually have these conversations and answer some of the big questions that can be really tricky to navigate. And it was definitely really useful and interesting to do some more formal research into copyright law and what the kind of legal parameters are around IP. But still, what's like legally right can only take you so far. It's still really about how those personal relationships in business like play out and how you sort of navigate those. But yeah, our team at Media Arts Lawyers helped us to refine our understanding and wording of things like moral rights, or like terms that sort of get thrown around a lot, but they're not like widely understood. And so I learned a lot there. And in the end, it just felt really good to be spending my time writing something that I feel very strongly is incredibly important. And the early reaction so far from those who've looked at it has really reinforced that for me anyway. I don't know. I'm both scared and excited to hear from people who have opposing views, I guess. It's going to be really important to open this dialogue up to different parties and try and further refine what we collectively feel is the best model for a healthy industry. And that's the whole point. We've got, as you mentioned, the letters, which makes more sense when you look at it. There's a client letter and an artist letter. And those are also provided as like Google Docs that you can make suggestions and comments on. So I'm like really, really keen to hear from people who perhaps don't agree, even though that terrifies me to my core. But it will be, you know, it'll be interesting once the conversation continues.
Awesome. Stan, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this on so many levels. Firstly, you're one of the first people who will actually be reading and seeing this campaign as the time of recording. we'll have just announced it yesterday. And obviously
last night,
indeed. And anything we do at Jackie Window, there's going to be a huge slant towards illustration animation, but you know, two industries where the idea of licensing and usage is not so foreign. But I want to hear from you, your perspective as a fine artist, on where, if anywhere, the concept of usage or licensing figures into your fine art practice or people kind of in your circle. Last week, we spoke about the AOI and their Not a Hobby campaign. Closer to home, we've also discussed the amazing work that organizations such as NAVA are doing, for example, with their own kind of code of practice, especially in kind of setting fair wages for artists and art workers. But I also know that for many visual artists, licensing of imagery is kind of more of a bonus. That's a kind of something that, if it happens, kind of great. It's not a main kind of stream of income. And there is kind of this whole amorphous idea of kind of pricing in art being this very subjective factor. But like all creatives, we all need different streams of income. So to that end, I'm curious to know if there's anything here that you think is relevant for artists more on the fine art side of the spectrum, like yourself, or on the flip side, is there anything illustrators and more commercial artists can learn about value-based pricing from the fine art world?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's so much to say, I don't even know where to start.
It's a bit like that with this.
I mean, I think any support for any creativity is a really, really good thing. And creative people are often the ones that are kind of taken advantage of, or sometimes don't come from this background of legalese or business strategy to really be able to fend for themselves. And so often we're made to feel that we're greedy because we're asking for minimum wage, you know, or basic licensing or basic rights or agreements.
Any money at all. Yeah, because it's like, you do this for fun, don't you?
Exactly. I think the big thing with art is that it obviously reflects a lot of overheads, a lot of production, a lot of creating and careering and workshops and materials and trial and error. And that's a whole beast in itself. But also what that means is we're actually a really sustainable industry in the scheme of things. We make very little because we go off scarcity, you know, and I think that's something that a lot of industries kind of have a lot to learn from, and, you know, especially industries that deal with merchandising in any way. And I think something like Nava is a really incredible resource to be able to just point clients to, and it ends a lot of conversations in a kind of really empowering way. Mm. And I think to be able to just refer clients to a really basic document dump and some really basic copy, and without having to explain it yourself, is an incredible resource. And I actually really like how you're saying it's not finished. And I think there's something so cool about being vulnerable and dumping process and files and kind of growing as it needs to grow and kind of being reactive to community. I think it's a really cool and quite radical thing, and it's kind of co-opted in a really good way.
Mm. Has licensing ever kind of come up in your practice in any way at all? Like, and, you know, I know, for example, like, yeah, you work with maps a lot, and maps are kind of something that is kind of heavily licensed kind of thing that you might have to purchase. Or have you ever been asked to kind of license your work for commercial purposes?
Yeah, I guess I'm a complete brat, so I would.
That's how I describe you to people.
No. So I'm a complete brat. I work in full independence, so I don't work with governments. I don't even work with NGOs. Everything is done fully, completely independently. Data is never unsold. You know, data is truly the medium of the 21st century. Mm. And to use the poetics of that, I also refuse to play that game. So for me, it's very, very important that my work and especially my data is never licensed and never kind of public or to be able to be used by anyone who I kind of have a slight arched eyebrow about. But it has come into being an artist. And I think a really big consideration is, and I think especially someone like me who kind of lives and bleeds for their work, is context is everything. And you have to be so protective about how it's seen, where it's seen. Yeah, it's something I'm very careful about. And licensing is a really interesting thing like that, because you can renew your contract. And if you're working with someone who maybe errs on the side of ethics that you're not into, it becomes a lot easier to pull back and have control as an artist.
Well, it's all about control, isn't it? It's about retaining that control over your work. And for something, you know, the kind of stuff that you do, being able to do your work independently is incredible. And the fact that you figured out how to do that and continue to figure out how to do that is amazing, because that doesn't sound easy. And then for commercial artists who obviously can't do that, because the whole point is that they're working commercially, but licensing allows them to work in a commercial space while still retaining some control over their output and their style and the thing that makes their living, you know? So it is really, it's an important topic to get your head around.
Yeah, I guess for me, it's also a thing when we don't come from this background. Is there are legal things or business terms, and particularly with legals, when you think about a phrase like usage or coercion or intimidation, legally they have completely different meanings, whether it's a family violence form or it's a corporate law or it's arts law. Mm. They mean completely different things. And not only that, but they mean completely different things by paperwork and by form and by each kind of clause. So it's really important to have clarity around those things. And That's a place where artists can really freak out.
Understandably.
I'm curious to know how you go about kind of pricing your work. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, I know you show a lot of work with galleries, and, you know, there's that has kind of commercial opportunity there. People can kind of purchase the manifestations of the work, whether they're kind of, they're almost kind of like sculptural pieces in kind of some ways, the pieces that I'm more familiar with. When you kind of, I know it's always so hard. I mean, we have Lemington Drive here, which is a gallery, but operates in a very kind of different way. And every time an artist comes to me and asks me, like, how much should I charge for this? I was like, ugh. But if someone asks me, like, how much do I charge for a piece of illustration, I'm kind of on it. I can figure it out.
I relate so much there.
What goes through your head when you have to kind of, when you have to figure out how to ascribe value to your work, financial value?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's really important to me that work that I do isn't a profit practice. So the pieces, they're expensive works to make. Mm. And so the cost of that basically reflects the overheads of what it takes for the work to exist, and not much else. Mm. And I make very, very little, actually. I make very few original works a year, and I'm very careful about where they end up. Mm. And that lets me not pump the work as a commercial product or to exploit anything. And it really allows me to retain maximum control over what I'm saying and where it ends up. And that's really important for me. So then I have a kind of second side to my practice, which is more commercial work and things that I absolutely love doing and love working with teams and briefs and responses. And it's a beautiful way to offload my primary studio practice, where it's really difficult, you know, and it's all self-directed. It's me top down, and it needs to be like that. It absolutely needs to be like that. But at the same time, it's really nice to kind of have a second thing, which takes some of the emotional weight off it, and you get to work with people and also extend your practice. And sometimes those ideas or methodologies or materials might end up back in your primary practice. And that's kind of how I've separated the two. And it's not easy. Mm-hmm. But I learned, and I think it might be really interesting here, is I learned a huge amount of working for luxury labels. And they have, and it sounds so brainwashed, but honestly, there have been incredible experiences every single time. And I don't have a single bad thing to say about that. And I know that's really, really rare. But what I found is from big companies is they are so incredible at retaining control of how their work is seen, you know, to the most minute, ridiculous, but incredible levels. And as an artist, I didn't know you were kind of expected to retain control like that, or it was okay to do that, or that it was industry standard, because especially as a young artist and as a woman, an immigrant and all these other things, you kind of bend backwards for work and please everybody. And I didn't know that this was an expected thing.
Mm.
But what I also found with luxury clients is they, it's like when they decide on you, they've just decided on you, and everything from that is support. So they use less people, but they do better. And they also grow with those people and ongoing relationships. And I think that's such a wonderful model for clients of all sorts to use, you know.
Completely. We've seen that play out with other artists as well. You think about like the relationships that Megan Hess, for example, has with certain brands, and it's, yeah, I think you'd probably have similar things to say.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, you know, comes from confidence in your practice and confidence that you're doing something right and following that kind of core there. And I think that's kind of something that is kind of hard to get kind of out of the gates. And I think, yeah, it's important to know that kind of what you're doing kind of has like, you know, kind of a certain, you know, has a kind of certain standard there that's there. And I think that's why we're kind of trying to do this. And I think also having that kind of duality in your practice is, I think that's a real positive thing, especially kind of seeing how you've done it. And, you know, I might have kind of said it a bit more in a more negative light, kind of saying how, you know, artists do have to kind of work on many different things to kind of be relevant and make ends meet. I think, you know, that obviously kind of goes on a spectrum. I think it can be very kind of stressful when it's kind of three or four things, and sometimes there's things outside your field, et cetera, and that you feel like you're kind of juggling. But I think, you know, if there's kind of two direct things that are kind of working in cooperation with each other, that can be really kind of strong. So yeah, it's a really interesting perspective. Thanks for sharing. Laura, anything else to add on this one?
Go read it.
Go read it. Indeed.
And if you have any complaints or feedback that's negative, talk to Jeremy, not me. I'll take the praise. I've got the praise hotline. Jeremy's got the complaints hotline.
Yeah, look, I'd like to invite everyone to please check it out. Sign the pledge. Help pass it on. It's been a real labor of love for the last 18 months. And it just big thank you to our web partners as well, Studio PDA. So Pete and James, who kind of have, you know, gotten this up technically. And yeah, the link.
I even got to play designer at some point where I had to choose color palettes. That was terrifying. I don't do color.
The link is useit.orlose.it. You know, the whole thing actually just starts as another domain ploy. Like, how can I just make something funny happen with a domain?
You have so many domains now. It's actually crazy.
Anyway, check it out. Sign it. Let us know what you think. We'll move on from there. Thank you. As we do every week, our final link comes from our special guest. Stan, before you tell us about what you brought to the table today, I'm curious to know a bit more about what your internet hygiene is like. Kind of where do you find links? Are you an active kind of reader online, or yeah, tell us everything.
Oh, that's very interesting. And doing open tabs for you guys was such a pleasure, because I also realized by the time I'm done with my inbox, I don't really want to look at a screen anymore.
Yeah.
So I am. I'm a really curious and avid reader and a bit of a restless brain. I do read a lot of books, and that's kind of necessary for the research and academic practice of my work. And then by the time I'm sort of done with the New York Times and the New Yorker, I'm usually good.
Yeah.
But in transit, I do kind of go through the links everyone sent me and kind of the backlog of bookmarks and, you know, then feel like a jerk because it took me 2 months to read and it was really incredible. And it was very considerate that someone sent it to me.
So tell us about this piece. Where did this come from?
So this is the New York Times Tea magazine over the weekend. And I thought it was a really great article and actually tied into what we were talking about with Use It or Lose It in such a strong way. And it's titled, As Rents Rise, Artists Are Reviving the Idea of the Medieval Guild. And it's a really great article that sort of talks about the need for collective studios or unions or co-ops, and kind of how maybe the future is in sharing resources, and especially in cities where artists are being pushed out. Is how much power there is in forming together, you know?
Do you know about medieval guilds, anyone? What were they?
I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time in any, but they just say here, it's like starting in the Middle Ages when craft guilds were first conceived in Western Europe, Artisans from haberdashers to glassmakers have organized themselves in skill-based communities to control production and quality, support apprenticeship, and obtain local influence. And so I guess it's looking at this article is really interesting in looking at how sort of people are doing this in a kind of modern day way. And I think we have a few examples in Melbourne as well that we can sort of point to. But it would be super interesting. I mean, you've done so much travel. Like, you are all over the bloody place. And it's incredible. But also, I'd say, to say the least, off the beaten path somewhat, not necessarily, you know, you're not going to like the hotel strip in Cancun. But I'd love to know like where you've seen examples of this kind of sort of cooperative kind of shared space in this sense in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many great places. I've got quite a few friends in Sydney who are painters and need, you know, use turpentine and exhaust and all these things that other artists don't necessarily need to be around. And it's really great that you can kind of co-op whole floors and these kind of equipment. And it's really, really basic, but also it gives you this incredible support network.
Have you ever worked in that kind of atmosphere, or are you someone who's kind of more of a solo worker?
I really dream of the commune, and I really dream of this incredible building, and the studios profiled in this piece are so beautiful and wonderful.
That your work particular.
Your work itself is kind of almost like, I mean, I don't want to be so corny here, but the world is your studio because you're always in different places because your work is very social, like especially, I mean, with the tattoos work that you do, which we haven't kind of touched upon, but it's always about kind of making that connection kind of with another kind of person in that way, also kind of mapping and kind of all those other things. So yeah, like that's interesting that, you know, how you kind of, that's kind of something you want, but maybe haven't experienced this kind of yet, like in this kind of more formal way, because it does require, I guess, a real commitment to a space in that way. Like you have to be really there, because the spaces that they cover here, I mean, some of them are just really just amazing.
Well, there's also the article, sorry to jump in.
No.
I was going to say, there's that article that was going around about how there's sort of been the decline in like art communities, not just physically, but in, well, like sort of digital art communities kind of destroyed physical art communities. And now those digital art communities have kind of fallen apart as well. Things like DeviantArt or whatever, where people really did actually form communities. Like, and I always think it's interesting because art, or in sort of in, you look at the history of it and the history of artists and how it's a thing that can actually be quite expensive to do in terms of like the materials, the training, the, all of the, you know, the space that it takes to do a lot of sort of practices. If you're not just like say drawing with pencil, you know, especially sculptural works and things like that, it can take a lot of money, but it's not often a career that brings in a lot of money. And so you get these communities that rely on each other to share resources and to share information, to share tools, whatever it may be, and to defend those from other things. And so it's really interesting to see this coming back. Jeremy, I remember a Creative Mornings ages ago, was it Pop and Scott?
Mm-hmm.
They did a really, really good talk about their, and like, we've talked about this before. My memory is so shot. It's so bad. But I vaguely remember them doing this amazing talk about how they had this, they sort of built this workshop space in maybe Brunswick or something. I don't know what my memory is serving me correctly, but and how they were bringing in other sort of, because they do sort of furniture and homewares and whatever else, and how they were bringing in other kind of artisan makers into this shop so that they could use their, because woodwork tools are so expensive, like proper industrial grade woodwork tools are really, really expensive. And they had this space where other sort of makers could come in to create either sort of personal works or actual sort of things to be sold. And it was a really interesting model, the way that they were doing it. And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh God, I wish I had any reason to use something like that, like if I had any physical skills whatsoever.
Absolutely. And sharing these things also can expand your practice, because
completely.
Would I make different things if I didn't just jump into sculpture workshops when I needed to, when I had the idea? But I had these incredible things around that I wouldn't otherwise buy or afford, but also don't need to use 98% of the time.
Yes.
You know, and how much does that also, do you come there with the purpose of your practice, but also how much does it expand your practice? And also it kind of supports what you need, but lets other people come in and jump in, or touring artists or, you know, museums to come in and just borrow the space as they might need to. And it's really powerful and such a
Completely.
Great way to maybe pay for your own practice in a way.
I think it's interesting though to look at, because a lot of these, some of the ones I profile here and also just others that I know about, are actually funded, or at least in part funded by the government. And what the difference is between ones that might be completely independent and the ones that are actually a funded space that you have to like apply for. And, you know, because like the first one they look at, which is La Friche, La Belle de Mai, which just sounds so fun. they talk about, it's like in this like shuttered tobacco factory, and like it's pretty incredible. But that sort of French and local governments have given La Friche more than $30 million since 2004. So there's definitely funding coming from, which is not a bad thing, but it's gone towards, you know, renovating like the studios, exhibition spaces. They installed two new theaters, a skateboard park, community gardens, on-site bookshop, cafe, childcare center, things like that, that probably would not have been possible whatsoever without the, yeah.
And what I loved is now they're saying they're thinking about hosting an elementary school in there.
Yeah.
And how incredible that outer spaces can kind of permeate into these interesting things, but also how this one in Marseille that they had Jean Nouvel as the, one of the board members, and then how you can kind of, yeah, bring in a board and all these other support networks collectively to really rise up maybe what artists can do and also genuinely contribute to community.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, it is about having some support, I guess, and because making art, or I think about, even just think about illustration for a second, like can be so solitary, like the work that you're doing. You don't have colleagues, you don't have a boss, you don't have a HR department, you don't, like, it's very solitary work. And so you look at something like the Pencil Factory in New York and how you've got sort of all these artists that make a space for themselves, or they kind of build up a faux team, you know, a faux office of people that you can go to every day to do your work, and have people around you and have sort of this support network.
I think it's also that accountability as well.
Yes,
you know, if you're sitting next to somebody and you're kind of, you're working on something, you're going to be more inclined to kind of finish it, you know, if someone's kind of watching you, but also just kind of having all that kind of access to the other knowledge, the other people. I kind of think that, you know, I think people are realizing that isolation is very kind of dangerous in kind of lots of ways, especially for artists. Like, you know, there's just a natural tendency and a natural human drive to kind of be with people. And there's also this natural progression of what's kind of happening in on a more kind of financial sense in terms of development and how, you know, old buildings are kind of being renewed and how areas kind of get gentrified and how, we talked about this before with that piece in The Conversation, Laura, about, you know, how, what happens, you know, when these areas kind of are gentrified and how, you know, what part kind of artists, you know, take place in that. And I think the reason is, yeah, people want to be near art and they want to be near creativity.
Understandably.
Yeah, understandably. And I think what's happening now, I love that, you know, these spaces are consistently being highlighted because it once again kind of shows that it's kind of something that is possible and something that you can do. And it's something that governments are starting to actually place kind of value on as well.
Yeah, because you've got this trope of the starving artist, but I guess this kind of comes back to the licensing and all those kind of conversations about how artists make livings and the fact that it is an actual vocation. It is a career, not just a, well, for a lot of people, it's a hobby and that's fine as well. But, you know, it can be the one thing someone wants to do to make their income. And people, you know, in society get a lot of joy and pleasure and fulfillment out of experiencing those creations, and therefore it should be sort of paid for. I went to once, do you know Jamie Priest, painter?
No.
Yeah, he won the Packing Room Prize at the Archibald recently. But anyway, really talented guy and friend of a friend was like, I ended up somehow going, this is years ago now, he was living in like this, yeah, it was like, it felt kind of commune-y, but it was set up by the government in Sydney. It was like in Newtown or something. And it was like all these townhouses sort of that all sort of sat around like a sort of central gardens thing. And it was, you like applied. It was like a sponsored sort of space and you could live there. There was one guy who'd been there for like 20 years and you had to be an artist or a musician or something. And it was incredible because you've got like all these little townhouses and they're all shared by different artists and things. And around there were like people painting, people sculpting. There were like jazz musicians walking in and out with all these instruments. And I remember feeling like this is incredible that the government supports something like this. And also like so jealous that there's no like little producer's house or something where I could go.
Well, there's places like in San Francisco, like in
the prison. We just get WeWork.
I mean, let's talk about that. It's really interesting to see kind of how these aspects are kind of coming into a more kind of commercial sense. Like there was an article I read last week that I really love about kind of Bad Robot, which is J.J. Abrams' production company in California, how they kind of turned their offices like into this kind of factory, even though they're a traditional production studio. This whole idea of kind of making is something that, you know, is infused there kind of with them. Even with Jackie Winter, like I like to make sure that we have lots of weird stuff to kind of play with because I think, you know, that's, I don't know, that's fulfilling to me.
And you love to fidget.
And I do love to fidget. but there's also, at the same time, this huge proliferation of co-working spaces and kind of, which I kind of feel a bit mixed on in kind of a lot of ways. I think they're kind of they're on the kind of same spectrum as these kind of more cooperative places. And again, there's a lot of historical context here, whether it's the Bauhaus, which they mentioned in this article, or something like Andy Warhol's factory, for example, or even something like, you know, we did at the Compound Interest, you know, just kind of taking an old boiler making factory and kind of putting lots of different businesses in there. And so obviously where this is going, I don't know, like I just have lots of mixed feelings about this. Stan, I'm just kind of curious to hear from you. Like, how do you kind of reconcile kind of those two different things? Do you think there's space for kind of both of those to exist next to each other?
Well, I think it's so interesting, this article, and I have a little bit of a pet peeve with articles of this nature, actually, as much as I love all the profiles in here. is every now and again, and I think the New York Times and T Magazine are quite guilty of it, is there are these very easy tropes for journalism that I actually think are not true. So that, you know, guilds or co-ops are coming back. Artists have always worked in groups, yeah. And it's, even though we're often talked about as these solitary geniuses, mm. and, you know, sometimes we do need to withdraw, and things like War and Peace can only be written from incredible study of humans and then withdrawal from them. At the same time, artists have always co-opt, and whether yeah. that's raised single artists and greater profiles above the support network, it's never left. So when you think about Bauhaus, or when you think about the constructivists, or even you think about Memphis Group, you know, at no point did co-ops leave. It's, you know, yeah. sort of like those articles that are like, minimalism's back, maximalism's yeah. back. But minimalism and maximalism have never left. You know, when you've got Phoebe Philo at Celine, and then you've got Gucci going gangbusters. They're
yeah. different people of, like different things, and they always have.
They always exist, yeah. you know, and it's really lazy journalism. But I did read actually this really great article about a similar project in northern Amsterdam, where the commune was there for 2 years and it was so successful and did very similar things with cooking and kindergartens, that by the time the lease was up and the property prices were up, you know, 20-30% in the neighborhood, the artists didn't get a share of that, you know, and were booted. And so they kind of actually worked out a licensing agreement with the government to stay, but also profit from what they were bringing to the community. And it's kind of simple and really powerful, and yeah, such a testament to, I think, what's possible. And I thought this article was so wonderful at highlighting that.
Well, because you look at the Collingwood Arts Precinct that they've been sort of putting together, and I actually admittedly don't know that much about what's happening with it now. But, I mean, there's definitely, I think, an element there of like so many people, Collingwood prices have gone up insanely in the last 10 years, and how they've sort of trying to figure out, the government trying to fill out this balance of like, how do we keep, you know, the reason that everyone moves to this suburb, how do we keep it here and carve out a definite space for that, but also still keep people buying these expensive properties? And it's about them trying to find the balance there. Really quickly before we wrap, do either of you guys know anything about Ghost Ship?
Oh, I mean, the tragedy that happened.
The tragedy. Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting one to look at in terms of these like independent artists communities, and then also what can go wrong when there isn't kind of more formal, perhaps governmental or just institutional support. The New York Times did an incredible profile of about the sort of tragedy there, if anyone wants to read more about Ghost Ship.
And, you know, real talk also, irresponsible people and irresponsible managers.
Exactly.
Well, Stan, regardless, it's a beautiful piece to look at. I mean, yeah, the works are and spaces are very inspiring. So thanks for bringing it to the table, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Before we leave, it's time for our favorite segment, the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the completely majestic off of our chest.
Majestic this week. All
yes.
right.
Laura, what do you got for us this week?
Okay. I've got a massive, massive thumbs up. Have you ever heard of the Tiny Chef Show?
This is an Instagram thing.
Yes. Oh, yes. My God. It's changed my life. Like, genuinely has changed my life. Now, if I ever feel stressed or sad or any kind of emotion that isn't pure bliss, I just go to the Tiny Chef Show on Instagram, and it's just like, it's everything I love. It's like gorgeous animation of this like tiny miniature green chef character who, like, he has a cat called Miss Penny, who's a real cat, and he just like cooks and makes drinks and he sings and his voice is hilarious. And it's like, it's incredible animation. Like, it's really, really well done. And it's just the cutest thing, and it will just warm your soul in the most beautiful way. I just highly recommend everyone go see the Tiny Chef Show. It also has 350,000 followers, which is wild, but it's just like the most beautiful pursuit of someone who just makes something so fun and so heartwarming just for the sake of it, that has been so popular in this very deep, dark world. It's just like a beautiful light. I love it.
It's a mental sorbet.
Seriously, it is. Tiny Chef Show, do it right this second. You will not regret it.
Stan, you have something for us this week?
I've got a thumbs up. I've got a shaka. I think it falls under everything good under the sun, and it's the Instagram account Biggie Pop, which is dedicated to Iggy Pop's pet cockatiel, who is incredibly musical, and it is a love affair of the biggest kind between the two of them. And he sings to it, and it taps, and it dances, and it warms my heart.
Oh, my God. I've just found this is hilarious. I know what I'm spending the rest of my day doing.
I feel bad. I don't have an animal-related Instagram account to talk about.
Oh, my God. I have millions if you want any.
No, mine is like probably the complete opposite of that spectrum. This is the Hanjet EBS260 portable inkjet printer.
That's what I was going to say.
This thing is insane. I'll put some photos on the podcast so you can see. I've been seeing lots of this kind of on the internet lately, and I think it's Dale from Dale Jones, amazing furniture company who had a show in the compound the other week, actually got one of the only ones here in Australia on this. And basically, it's just this kind of wand that prints things as you roll over it, basically. So it's like you can kind of do, you know, shirts and just kind of roll down the artwork, or kind of it's meant for industrial purposes, like for kind of like vats and tanks of things and boxes and things like that. But the potential to see how it could be used for art is super interesting. And so, yeah, going back to the whole idea of factories and just having lots of weird stuff in the office, there may be one, I don't know, coming here in the next 12 months. Maybe not. Probably not. It's very expensive.
12 months?
It's very expensive, but a big thumbs up to just totally weird tech that should definitely be repurposed for other needs. But that'll do us for this week. Stan, if people want to find out more about you, your practice, where can they find you on the internet?
It's miso.com with dashes in between the letters.
That's MIS-O.
.com.
There's a jingle right there. Thank you again so much for coming in.
Thanks so much. We love having you.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Lara Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. And if you want more JYGY TV, archives of all of our shows and the links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about in one neat little package every week, sign up to our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, that's jwg.is/newslettering. And you can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y in winter like this season, and hit us up with any recommendations, etc., questions or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, or any other supported player, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you so much for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. Stan, anything you'd like to particularly endorse, disendorse, just kind of air?
I would, editors. Can I just Google it quickly?
Yeah, of course.
So I got everything right in the details.
Please.
Oh, got it.